Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good afternoon, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. You can find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Joseph Fink, President Emeritus of Dominican University in Marin County, California. I'm also the former chair of the Commonwealth Club's Board of Governors. And more importantly for today, I'm the moderator of this program. It's now my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, Bill Bradley, the former United States Senator from New Jersey and author of a new book, We Can All Do Better. The phrase Renaissance Man is often tossed around fairly freely. But in this case, I think I can use it with confidence and satisfaction. Senator Bradley holds a BA degree in American history from Princeton University and an MA degree from Oxford University, where he was a Rhodes Scholar. He was an Olympic gold medalist, and as we all know, a professional basketball player with the New York Knicks. He was elected to the United States Basketball Hall of Fame. He served in the United States Senate from 1979 to 1997, three terms representing New Jersey. In 2000, he was a candidate for the Democratic nomination for President of the United States. He was also worked as an essayist for CBS Evening News and was a visiting professor at Stanford, the University of Notre Dame, and the University of Maryland. He was also a senior advisor and vice chairman of the International Council of J.P. Morgan & Company, and is presently the managing director of Allen & Company in New York. He also hosts American Voices, a remarkable weekly radio show on satellite radio that highlights the accomplishments of Americans who are both famous and unknown. Senator Bradley, I'm not sure whether you cook or dance, but to me, you're a Renaissance man. Welcome.
Thank you, Dr. Fink, for that introduction, and I actually dance better than I cook. I appreciate the opportunity to be back at the Commonwealth Club. I remember speaking here several times over the last 25 or 30 years, and I think it's a great community forum, and I'm very happy to be here. And I particularly appreciate the introduction of Dr. Fink. I will tell you that, you know, I have a book called We Can All Do Better. It's, I think, my seventh book. And you go around and talk about your book whenever you have written one because you kind of want people to read it. And it supposedly helps to do that. And I've received a lot of different introductions. And sometimes people aren't as professional as Dr. Fink. I remember one person introduced me and said, we have here today Senator Bill Bradley, who will talk about his new book, whatever it was. It's a great book. And when you put it down, you'll never pick it up. And that's a slight confusion, anyway. But I also remember one time in the Senate Energy Committee, Dr. Henry Kissinger was testifying on the geopolitics of oil. And the chairman of the committee said, Dr. Kissinger, welcome to the committee. You've just published this book. It was his 820-page memoir. And the chairman said, we can learn so much from you. I'm reading your book, and I find it very insightful. But I would say to the members of the committee that I advise you to be careful if you read the book in bed, because if you fall asleep and it drops out of your hand, it'll break your leg. Well, I can guarantee you this book does not present that problem. It's a slimmer volume than the 850-page Kissinger memoir. And the impetus for the book really was last year last summer, I looked out and I saw the debt limit debacle. I saw us still in two wars. I saw the middle class still stuck. I mean, the median income in 2010 was the same as it was in 1996. And I actually had people come up to me and say, Bill, do you think this is hopeless? You think we're stuck? And so one of the reasons I wrote this book was to give people hope, to remind us that we've had difficult times in the past, depressions, wars, and we've overcome them and moved on. To remind them that our political institutions are flexible enough to allow us to deal with whatever problem we might face. And also to remind them of something that I said during the years I ran for the presidency, which was the goodness of the American people. To remind us that there's a goodness in the American people, a kind of selflessness that we must never ignore and that we must understand can be the foundation for whatever decisions we make. I mean, people ask me these days, well, what do you miss about being in politics? And I miss two things. First thing I miss is not doing public policy 24 hours a day. I love that. I mean, I remember being in this room in the mid-90s talking about water reform in California. I'm sure I was the only New Jersey senator ever to be in this room talking about water reform in California. But I love the subject. I love the more complex, the more interesting. And I try to fill that void by writing books such as We Can All Do Better. The second thing I miss are the people, quite frankly, in all their shapes and sizes and their dreams and angers and hopes and anxieties. And I try to fill that void with the program that Dr. Fink alluded to on SiriusXM satellite radio called American Voices, where I interview people all over the country about their lives. And the premise is for my listeners to hear the kind of stories that I heard on the road in America for 40 years as a basketball player and a politician. And the stories boil down into two types. The first type is usually about somebody who has an unusual job, like the guy that washes the skyscrapers' windows at 40 stories up in New York City, or a public health nurse in the Aleutian Islands that goes island to island, or a groundskeeper at Fenway Park in Boston. And I've done over 300 stories, so I've interviewed a lot of people about what they do. And these interviews are really about the dignity of work and the satisfaction and fulfillment that someone derives from doing their job well, whatever the job is. And then the second kind of interview is usually about someone who's doing something selfless in their communities. What I wanted to remind the people of in part in writing this book, Chapter 5, is called Celebrating Selflessness. It's such as the guy I interviewed in Pittsburgh who shined shoes at the Pittsburgh Children's Hospital for 46 years. And out of every tip he got over that time, he put a portion of it into a fund for poor kids' health care. And the day I interviewed him, he put over $100,000 into that fund. The goodness of the American people. And I remember one woman I interviewed outside Chicago. She had an 11-year-old son who had cancer. And when he was in the hospital, he got a lot of letters from people. And he came home, and the letters stopped. And he said to his mother one day, Mom, are they not sending me letters because they know I'm going to die? And so his mother started sending him letters. And she signed the letter, A Secret Pal. And on a bad week when he was home and sick, she'd send him three letters. But on a good week when he was in school, he would at least get one letter a week. And one night she came into the kitchen, he was sitting at the table and writing, and she kind of looked at him and said, what are you doing? No, it's not for you, Mom. And so he finishes writing, puts this little piece of paper into an envelope, gives this to his mother and says, Mom, will you give this to my secret pal? And so she started to look at it. No, no, Mom, not you. I mean my secret pal. And so she put him to bed, came back out, and, you know, what would you do? And she opened the envelope, and there was a letter that was really one sentence. And it said, I love you, Mom. And about 4 months later, he died. And she went into his closet to do the most difficult job a parent could possibly do, which is cleaning up after the death of a child. And she found in the bottom of the closet a shoebox full of all the letters that he had gotten from his secret pal, organized chronologically. And at the bottom of the shoebox was an address book. And in the address were the addresses of all the kids that the previous summer had attended the Kids with Cancer camp that her son had gone to. And so as out of a tribute to her son, she wrote each one of the kids in that book, address book, trying to buck them up like she had bucked up her son during those difficult months. And really a funny thing happened, wonderful thing happened. She started to get letters from people all over the country saying, you wrote to my cousin's son who has cancer in Kansas City, and I have a friend whose son has cancer in Denver. Could you write to him? Another person would write and say, you wrote to my next door neighbor whose daughter had cancer. I have another friend whose child has cancer in Syracuse, New York. Would you write to him or her? And so she did that, and she responded. And she created an organization called Love Letters. And over 10 years, she wrote over 4,000 letters to kids with cancer. And a remarkable woman. That's what I call the goodness of the American people. So when we talk about our national politics, I think we must never lose sight of that foundation of who we are as a people. From the very beginning, remember the stories, the neighbors helped each other raise the barns in the early days of the country. And there are always people who give to other people without any expectation of return. And indeed, if you think about that, I think that's probably government is at its best when it takes the ethos of that nonprofit sector, which is give to somebody with no expectation of return, and the ethos of the private sector, which is perform or die, and puts into public policy, into government, the accountability of the private sector and the motivation of the nonprofit sector. And so when we think about our problems, we have to remember that foundation, because that's who we are as a people. So the impetus was there. What was the inspiration for this book? The inspiration came from Abraham Lincoln's second State of the Union address in 1862. The war's been going on about a year. It's not going well for the North. It's about 6 to 8 months from the Emancipation Proclamation. And so Lincoln sends this incredible address to the Congress. It's one of the great addresses in American history. And he says so many wonderful things, so many memorable things. But there are two or three sentences that caught my attention in our current context. And he says in there, we can only succeed by concert, working together. It's not, can any of us imagine better? But can all of us do better? And so that's the question that Lincoln posed, that I pose in this book. Can we all do better? Very relevant when you look out at the fragility and inequality of our economy, the direction of our foreign policy, the paralysis of our national dialogue. A very relevant question. But it goes deeper than that. It goes to us as individuals as well. Because if we're going to meet the challenges of our country in the next 30 or 40 years, each of us is going to have to be at our best. And yet at the same time, we must seek to be at our best with an awareness that even if we're at our best, our fate as individuals will be determined by the success or failure of our national community. You think about politics today, and it's really a battle between two competing ethics. There's the ethic of caring, collective action, usually associated with Democrats, and the ethic of responsibility, individual action, usually associated with Republicans. And that's what the debate is. You see the presidential beginning to heat up. And if we can get beyond these very important issues, like does President Obama, did he ever eat a dog, or did Romney beat up a kid on a playground when he was 12 years old? If we can get beyond those to the real issues, then I think it's a very relevant question. Can we all do better? And so I ask that because, you know, this battle between two competing ethics. The truth is, and we need politicians to put country ahead of party and tell us the truth. The truth is that we need both. Each is incomplete. Only when collective caring and individual responsibility are together can we be at our best as a nation. For example, health care. Everybody in America should have access to health care. That's a basic value. You know, do you believe that because this is a fellow human being, or do you not believe that? Everybody should have, and you only do that with collective caring, action that flows from that. At the same time, individual responsibility would say, you're in charge of one thing, really, your own body. So the better care you take of your own body, the less you're going to cost the healthcare system and the more money that would be available to cover people who don't have health insurance. Collective caring, individual responsibility. Take pensions. Social Security, collective caring. And for 35% of the elderly, it's the only income they have. That Social Security check. That's it. They live on it. And yet, if you want a full retirement, it's better than Social Security, and Social Security is collective caring, individual responsibility would say, you got to save. You know, the people that wake up when they're 55 and say, oh, I got to start saving. You know, the power of compound interest, my father taught me very early, you know, save a little bit all along. But that's individual responsibility. So that's kind of where we are. And as I thought about what I was going to say in the book, I realized I can't talk about 100 issues. I wanted to talk about what I felt were the three important issues. One is the economy. Second is foreign policy. The third is the structure of our democracy. Because I think those will determine our future. Not that other issues aren't important, environment, healthcare, etc. But those are the three. And so with the economy, what is the issue? The issue is, as I said earlier, that middle-income people have not been moving up in America. That in 2010, median income, same as it was in 1996, that there are 66 million Americans that are one paycheck away from economic catastrophe. That who we are as Americans has always been defined by our belief that if you work hard and abide by the rules, you can move up. That upward mobility has driven ambition and it's driven achievement. And for a generation now, because it's been going on for 25 years, 30 years, people begin to say, well, am I ever going to get ahead? I mean, you know, if that income that one earner in the family makes is not enough, what's happened, of course, is we've been a second earner in the family. And when that wasn't enough, the family had one asset, their home. They borrowed up the value of their home and spent it like it was a raise. And then 2008 came, or 2007, 2008, and suddenly they're in deep trouble. So the economic part of what I talk about relates to how do we get more people working at higher incomes, thereby, once again, fostering a belief in upward mobility in our country. And I go into some detail. I can tell you in questions and answers if you'd like. And then foreign policy. Foreign policy, the basic point is the 21st century will be determined by economics more than military action. 20th century, military action. Global, you know, two world wars, Korean War, Vietnam War, all the other little wars. We are deploying forces all over the world, power projection. We can go anywhere, fight two wars simultaneously, maybe three. And that's where our power came from. 21st century, it's got to come from our economic strength. Because we have to understand the world we're living in. And the world we're living in is one in which there is a burgeoning power, burgeoning economic power, China. And I remember Lee Kuan Yew, who is the founder and former prime minister of Singapore, and he said, you know, the 21st century will be determined by intelligence. And he said, look at China. They have a talent pool of 1.3 billion. But he said, the United States has a talent pool of 7 billion. Meaning as long as we are open, as long as we don't shut off to immigration, our value systems, the openness of our society can attract the best people in the world to come to America and help us excel, even as we develop our homegrown talent. And that's even more relevant when you look at replacement rates, you know, number of people that born versus number of people that die. In order to replace your population, it has to be like 2.1 per 1,000. And we're now like 1.8. So immigration is also relevant to being able to keep our promises to the elderly in health care, Medicare, and other things. So China is taking very long-term decisions, very long-term decisions. They're building the structure for economic power in the 21st century. What kind of things? Well, they're talking about high-speed rail line from China into Southeast Asia to Singapore, across Central Asia to Turkey, across Siberia to Moscow and to Berlin, from which they will be able to drain resources into China. They're talking about building dams on, not the Three Gorges, but dams on the Mekong, the Irrawaddy, the Brahmaputra, all are rivers originating in the Himalayas and flowing south to Southeast Asia and Asia. So by building those dams, they'll be able to have an influence on these countries by controlling the water supply without firing a shot. You might have seen a story last summer of the Chinese tycoon who wants to buy 200 square kilometers of Iceland. And when somebody asked him, well, why do you want to do it? He said, I want to build a resort. And yet, there probably is another reason. And that is thinking ahead, one decade, two decades, three decades, global warming, instead of 4 months a year to go over the pole, you can go over 12 months of the year. Where's the key place that's not Europe and not America on that trade route? It's Iceland. These are long-term decisions. We have to begin to think that way. And we have to begin to act that way. A story, October 29th, in front page of the New York Times, two stories. One story says, Europeans go to China to seek investment in Euro Rescue Fund. Story continues. Chinese say they consider it if Europe would agree to changing their status under the WTO, World Trade Organization, so they'd be a market economy and therefore not subject to the kind of sanctions that they can be subject to in their current state. It was the story of a growing economic power using its muscle economically. Right next to it was the following story. Headline said, Western business looks for investment in Libya. It was the story of us picking over the bones of our latest Mideast adventure. There's a tremendous opportunity cost to for the last 12 years, pouring our best talent, the thinking of our best people, the lives of some of our loyalist citizens into the desert sands of Iraq and Afghanistan. Not that we don't need a strong military, not that we don't need a strong navy, of course we do. But adventures far away from the United States for dubious purposes and taking all that talent that is then not available for thinking about long-term economic things in our country has real costs. And that's what we have to, I talk about this at, you know, some length, as long as you can talk about it in a thin book. Henry Kissinger would have talked about it, you know, much longer. But then I try to get right to the point. Then the last area is our political institutions. Two problems. One, gerrymandering, drawing congressional district lines. Out of 435 congressmen, only 50 are competitive, and the rest play not to the center because they're going to get reelected if they're in a 60-40 district, Republican or Democrat. But they worry about a challenge in their primary, so that if they're in the Republican Party, they got to play the Tea Party. If they're in the Democratic Party, they got to play to whatever is the left of where the mainstream is. And until we deal with that, and California actually is on the cutting edge here with this idea of commissions drawing lines, we're going to continue to have this polarization. Second problem, money in politics. When I ran for the Senate the first time in 1978, I spent $1.68 million on primary and general election. John Corzine ran for that seat in 2000, spent $63 million. $63 million, a large part of it his own, courtesy of the Supreme Court, who said in 1976, you can't limit the amount of money a person spends on his campaign or her campaign because you're limiting that person's right to free speech. As a result, when you go, say, a campaign committee says, well, that's who we're going to get to run in this district or this state. And they interview people and always ask the same question, can you raise money? And of course, the person says, well, I can write the check, has the advantage. And that's why today in the Congress, 47% of the Congress and Senate are millionaires, 9% of the people are. Not that that skews policy, but it just simply makes the point about the role of money in politics. And then on top of that, in 2010, the Supreme Court ruled in Citizens United a mind-bogglingly disastrous ruling that repealed Teddy Roosevelt's law in 1907 that said corporations can't contribute to politicians. Because Roosevelt had been appalled at what he'd seen as the Vice President William McKinley in 1900. And this court ruling repealed that law. And the thought process was to say, since under rulings of the 19th century, the robber baron's court, a corporation was considered a person under the law, that you can't limit what a corporation spends on politics, but because that corporation is a person, you'd be limiting that person, corporation's, right to free speech. And therefore was born the super PACs. The stories where people, very wealthy people, are going to spend $100 million purveying lies. You saw this story about Barack Obama the other day. Somebody leaked that story to force the issue. So Mitt Romney would say, I don't want that. But I guarantee you, before this campaign is over, you're going to see an orgy of money, and it's going to be full of destructive lies. Republicans will have more because they always have more. But that's the way it is. So there's an answer to that, constitutional amendment, quite frankly. That's the only way you're going to deal with it. A constitutional amendment that says simply federal, state, and local governments may limit the amount of money spent in a political campaign. That has to pass the Congress and Senate, and then has to be ratified by three-quarters of the states. And then we can begin to say, okay, now what can we do? And, of course, at that point, I'd like public financing For $3 billion a year, out of a $3.5 trillion budget, you could take special interests totally out of politics. So those are some of the things that I try to cover, and we can all do better. And in 2000, there's one or two other points that I think are important. In 2008, remember that night in Chicago, that election night in Chicago? We made a mistake that night of believing that a leader can renew the country all by himself. But even somebody who touched our hearts as much as Barack Obama couldn't do that. It takes sergeants and lieutenants. It takes citizens. It takes people who realize that democracy is not a vicarious experience, and that in the internet age, there is no excuse. Apathy can't be an excuse for inaction. It shouldn't be an option. And we must reflect. Citizens have power that we do not even realize we have. Just take a look at a little history. In the 1830s, a group of people got together and they said, slavery is immoral. We're going to end it. Abolitionists. In the 1880s, a group of people got together and said, women should have a right to vote. The suffragists. In the 1950s, a group got together and said, we need to perfect this country's laws so that African Americans have a real shot at a good life in this country. Civil rights workers. In the 1970s, a group said, we can't have this dirty air and dirty water and encroaching on natural spaces. We need environmental laws, the environmentalists. Each of those were movements of citizens. Movements of citizens who, through their action, changed this country. Certainly we ought to be able to have a citizen movement today that says, deal with the real issues, like blocking money in politics, like having a plan to raise the living standard income of middle-income Americans and create more jobs. Follow a foreign policy that recognizes the reality of the 21st century as opposed to looking in the rearview mirror of the reality of the 20th century. And make major investments for all of us, not for some of us. Infrastructure. And so, people don't understand how much power they have. And, you know, there are two, when you talk about citizen activism these days, people say, well, the Tea Party and Occupy. That's true, but they were different. Not only ideologically different. Tea Party, first of all, was well-funded by very wealthy radical Republicans. They had a very specific objective, which was roll back government. And they made a decision, get involved in politics, win congressional seats, grab the levers of power. And in 2010, they elected 43 members of the House of Representatives who were Tea Party Republicans, who in the summer of 2011, in the debt limit talks when President Obama and Speaker Boehner had an agreement in principle on a $3 trillion deficit reduction. It was those 43 Tea Party Republicans that vetoed it because it had some taxes in it, and they almost bankrupt the country. And you see in the newspaper Boehner, because he's been pushed by those people, saying, we're going to have another round two of this in the fall. Occupy didn't have a lot of money. But it also didn't have a specific objective. Had a great slogan, we're the 99%, called attention to an important issue, income inequality. But it had no specific objective, and it chose not to get involved in electoral politics, not to grab for the levers of power. Unless you grab for the levers of power, you become interesting, but people don't pay attention to you. And I would point out one moment in American history where it all came together, the 1960s. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. had a moral vision, had a dream that stirred the hearts and souls of millions of Americans. Lyndon Johnson had that same dream. And because he knew how to use the levers of power, he took the dream of Dr. Martin Luther King and made it permanent in law and changed the country. So it takes passion, yes, but it also takes a knowledge of how to use the levers of power. And so these are some of the things I talk about in the book, that very slim volume that can be read on a long train ride or on a weekend without any problem. Thank you for letting me be at the Commonwealth Club.
Our thanks to Bill Bradley, former United States Senator from New Jersey and author of the new book, We Can All Do Better.
Dr. Fink, I'd just like to ask a question. You're seated, and I have to continue to stand.
That's true. Would you like to switch positions?
No, that's okay.
I would have thought you'd be in better shape than I would after all those years of playing basketball.
I won't respond.
We have a variety of questions, some of which are tend toward the philosophical, others tend toward the practical. Let me begin with one. You call for hope. Do you believe that bipartisanship can actually be alive in the next decade or so, especially when you have a minority leader of the Senate who claimed that his number one priority was to ensure the defeat of the president as opposed to what was best for the country?
Well, we're living in a time where I don't remember a time in American history where we've been confronted with such radicalism in the Republican Party. In the book, I point out how it's not even the tradition of the Republican Party. Lincoln was the first progressive. Homestead Act, Intercontinental Railroad, land-grant colleges, Teddy Roosevelt, Dwight Eisenhower, even George Bush I were moderate people who knew that government had a role in their lives. Tea Party, no. Roll back government. Dick Lugar, great senator, Republican, Indiana, defeated last week. The guy who defeated him said, the era of collegiality is over. The era of confrontation has come. And my idea of being a successful senator is to get Democrats to support my position. Such ignorance about American history. We wouldn't have even had a Constitution without compromise. We wouldn't have had the Civil Rights Bills without Republican Senator Everett Dirksen, who LBJ gave the first pen to because he was so central to the outcome. So we live in a time where we are living in an unusual period. No, I'm just kidding. For those that are listening on radio, he just brought me a stool after I made my thank you. Where was I? So that, we're living in a time where there's real radicalism. And how do you get around that? You only get around that with trust. It's hard to have trust of people you don't know. When I was in the Senate, you got to know people. You had dinners with them. Here they come in 3 days a week. Washington's evil. Therefore, they have fundraisers for 3 days in Washington and then go back to their districts and broadcast the same venom. But I also think that out of the Republican Party, in the Congress and in the Senate, there have got to be 25 or 30 who by background, education, know they're not doing the right thing. And I would hope that when we get to that potential train wreck time for from the election to January 1st, and we're trying to get an agreement that the president will have identified those people, call them in one by one, and he will know more about them than their mother. And he will know who their contributors are. He will know who they trust. He will know who advised them. He will know the businesses in their district that are important. He will know who their childhood friends were, who they listened to. Call them in and say, you know, you're a Republican, I'm a Democrat. You're going to hammer me, and I'm probably going to come back to you. But there are moments, and there are votes, when each of us has to be a patriot. And I'm afraid if we don't get this deficit reduction package that deals with out-year spending, not the next 2 years, but out-year, changing entitlements, defense, and increasing taxes, that the bond market's going to vote negative and we're going to have a major crisis. So I ask you, support me on this issue. I'd call a person, while he was there, I'd make sure, you know, if he wants a bourbon, he had a bourbon. If he wanted to have coffee, he could have coffee. I'd probably give him a little something from the White House, et cetera. And now, 10 days later, have you changed your, are you with me? And if he said yes, well, we've begun to do and get the right momentum toward the right objective. If he said no, I'd start by calling his mother. That's one way to get bipartisanship back.
In your book, you spend some time talking about the third party movement in the United States, starting with the Teddy Roosevelt and the Bull Moose party. You also talk about a congressional third party. Would you elaborate on that and explain that a little more, please?
Well, there have been times in American history where points of view were irreconcilable. Right before the Civil War comes to mind. But absent that, the way we resolve issues is with political combat. That is often vicious, but it's bloodless. And then what happens is one of three things. Either one party dominates the other and enacts its agenda, 1964 LBJ. Or you live in a period where there's a narrow majority and there has to be cooperation and bipartisanship, which is what it was the 18 years I was there, which is what it is still today. But if for whatever reason you have some radical element of one party that's traumatized the whole party and makes it incapable of actually getting agreement, then what you've had is the emergence, or what you could have, is the emergence of a third congressional party, not a presidential party, but a third congressional party that would have three or four very specific objectives, such as the constitutional amendment to limit money in politics, right? And a couple of others. And if there were 50 races in which this congressional party entered and they won 20 seats, they'd sit right at the fulcrum of power in the Congress. And so if one party or the other wanted to vote on something, well, how do you stand on a constitutional amendment? I can't give you the vote unless you agree to support that. And they just have the possibility of shaking up the system. Shaking up the system enough to begin to jar primarily the Republican Party, but also elements of the Democratic Party, into a realization that it's time to do the people's business. And I think that that's the value of a congressional third party, if it were to emerge.
Thank you. There are a number of questions regarding government influence and spending. Let me try to summarize them this way. The Depression, many historians claim, was really not satisfied except for the fact that the government spent enormously in the Second World War. Is there a need for an enormous stimulus package again? Was the first one, in your view, successful or not? Should there be a second one, and can it actually happen?
Okay. Well, first of all, looking at it from a historical standpoint, I think that some of the initiatives Roosevelt actually put forward were working, but then you had a Federal Reserve that didn't cooperate and raised interest rates, and so you ended up with another downturn in 1937. And that's the question today. Is there going to be another downturn? And I personally think that austerity for austerity's sake, deficit reduction for deficit reduction's sake this year or next year is probably not a wise thing. I think it's important to put it in place for the out years. I think we need to have a program to get more people working at better pay. What would I suggest? Well, I would suggest any business that hires another person and doesn't lay anybody off, for 2 years, the government will pay 30% of the cost of that person. Still has to be, the productivity has to be enhanced because the company's paying 70%, but the government could pay 30%. The value of that is every dollar that is spent, not one taxpayer dollar would be spent unless a job was created. The idea is create jobs. But then what do? Well, you... On the books of non-financial U.S. corporations are $1.8 trillion in cash and liquid assets. If 20% of that was used to hire people at the median income, about $49,000, unemployment would be 5%. When you talk to CEOs and say, well, why don't you do that? They say, uncertainty, got to have a rainy day fund, not sure what's happening out there. And second, there's no demand for the goods that I produce. So what do you want me to do, hire people and produce goods that will never be bought because people don't have income? So you have to address each of those. You address the first with a major deficit reduction package that has the taxes, defense, and entitlements. And if we do that, showing our creditors, China has lent us $1.4 trillion, that we have a downward trajectory for our debt, we could then say what we need now to address the demand side, we need a massive infrastructure program, $1 trillion over 5 years to do high-speed rail, to do a new air traffic control system, to do things of national significance, not shovel-ready things that every mayor in America has had on his list if there ever was enough money. And where will we get the money? Is that contradictory with the deficit reduction? No, it's not. Why? Because the Chinese still will be selling us goods and they'll have dollars. They got to invest those dollars somewhere. So if we create reconstruction funds and they invest in those bonds, you then have the opportunity to hire people at good wages. And one study I saw said for that program, you could create 5 million jobs a year. Those 5 million people would have incomes. They would begin to spend money and buy things. Deficit reduction removed the uncertainty. Now here we are buying things, and the companies have to then take some of that cash and hire people. And then we get back into the virtuous spiral up as opposed to the disastrous spiral down.
Thank you. Moving in a slightly different direction today, young people receive a great deal of their news through the Internet, more mature people still through television, radio. What's happened to, in your view, to news organizations? Have they become advocacy organizations? Are there any that we can trust today? What do you watch?
I think that news organizations have been endangered. We have more entertainment and less news. Instead of a network spending money on reporters to go out and find the facts that nobody knows, we hire celebrities to do point, counterpoint. We're unable to have a real analysis, at least on television. Newspapers are endangered. See what's happened in this town, even in New York Times. How's it going to go forward? Who's got the economic model that allow a New York Times quality paper or a Wall Street Journal quality paper to be on the web that we can use? So we're in a time where nobody knows where this is headed. But we are endangered if we are a country that doesn't know what's going on because our media is not telling us what's going on. And what do I read? You know, I read New York Times, I read USA Today, I read four or five newsletters from people I trust, I read a couple of blogs that I think really speak to the heart of the matter, I talk to smart people, I listen to opinions, and try to, you know, sift through all of this to decide what are the facts. Once I know the facts, I know what I think we should do, as I'm sure each of you do. But what are the facts? There's never been more information. You need a curator. You need a trusted curator. Or you need to find 5 to 10 places who will provide information that you know is going to be accurate. But it's absolutely critical. You know, it drives me crazy. You see news organizations making decisions. These very, you know, CBS Evening News, NBC, ABC, you know, there's a drive to have stories about entertainment, social, etc. Hard news, other people won't watch it. They want entertainment. Well, if news organizations provide over only entertainment, we have a real problem in this country.
Thank you. There are some pundits who have stated that President Obama's movement to embrace gay marriage was an attempt to move the public's attention away from the economy to social issues. Do you have a point of view about that?
Well, I doubt that is the case. On these kind of issues, I always think what a person should do, even if they're president, is say what they believe. And I think President Obama has finally said what he believed. And you can almost see the comfort level in his body language. And, you know, it's going to offend some people. It's going to please other people. It's not the key issues about the future of the country. It's indicative of where we are. And I think that, you know, the issue won't be a major issue in this presidential race.
Do you believe that President Obama failed when he did not embrace the Simpson-Bowles proposals when they first came to fruition?
Well, actually, he did. He didn't say when they came out, "I'm for Simpson-Bowles." But when he was in the room negotiating with John Boehner, what they negotiated in principle looked very similar to Simpson-Bowles. And if the Tea Party hadn't vetoed it when Boehner took it back to the caucus, we could very well have had that enacted, at which point there might have been some variations, but I'm sure my old friend Alan Simpson and Erskine Bowles would be saying, well, they did our thing. And so I think that he has showed a real willingness to head in the direction, but you have to have somebody to dance with, and nobody would dance with him on this.
I usually, on these events, don't ask questions unless I'm sure I know the facts behind them, but here's what I'm going to try on you. Can you comment on the class warfare approach of the Obama-Biden administration and compare it to your approach to the 1986 tax reform legislation?
Sure. Well, you know, in 1981, I did the amendment that raised taxes on the rich. It failed. 1986, we ended up having the wealthy pay a higher percent of the taxes, but we did that by eliminating the loopholes that some of the wealthy benefit from and cutting the tax rates that did benefit other of the wealthy, but benefited all people as well. And I've often felt that you want to invest so that everybody has a chance to move up. And that, should the wealthy pay more? Absolutely. It's part of the citizenship responsibility. Those who have more should pay more. But I think that the key thing is to make that an inclusive argument, that we're in this together. We're going to do this on entitlements, Social Security, Medicare. We're going to do this on defense. And here are some of the things we're going to do on upper income, or for that matter, financial transaction tax, or for that matter, a non-labor value-added tax. There are 100 things you can do. And I think I understand what the president's doing. He's using it as a way to say very clearly to middle-income people that he's on their side. And I think that, I don't know if it's working, but I think that's probably the strategy behind it.
Part of the some of our questioners are wondering how you see the role of lobbyists in Washington today, and is there any beneficial aspect to lobbying?
Well, when I was in the Senate, lobbyists can actually help you write a piece of law because they know their subjects very well. And they come in and they'll have 4 or 5 arguments or things you haven't thought of, even if you have a great staff, which I did, to go through the substance of the issues. So the issue isn't just lobbyists. The issue is the connection between lobbyists and money. If that person comes into your office at 3 in the afternoon and gives you an insight into whatever, infrastructure project, tax bill, trade bill, and then at 8 o'clock that night comes to a fundraiser and gives you $10,000, that's the problem. We have to break the link between lobbyists and money. And we have to do that because the money is preventing the Congress from dealing with the issues that the majority of America want to deal with. For example, in 2011, we had financial reform. 2009 and 10, the financial industry contributed $318 million to politicians in Washington. The healthcare industry contributed $145 million to politicians in Washington. And the energy industry contributed $75 million. Should it be any surprise that financial reform bill was watered down, or that the health care bill did not even have a public option to private health insurance, or that we didn't even get around to doing an energy bill, even as we're sending billions of dollars every day to autocrats on the other side of the world to feed our oil habit? So I think there's a direct connection between the way money filters into the system and policy results. And we have to face that fact. And that's why the constitutional amendment is so critical to our country's future.
Thank you. You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. And our guest is Bill Bradley, former United States Senator from New Jersey, who is discussing American politics today. Senator Bradley, is there anything that can be done by the what you referred to as the enormous amount of negative campaigning or negative commercials that we'll see what some pundits have termed to be hatred porn that's going to be flooding the airways? Is there anything to be done today?
Yeah. If you're a citizen and you see this, you do the opposite of what the commercial says. That's what you can do. I mean, what else can you do? You know, with the money as it is, yeah, a constitutional amendment, that's not going to happen between now and November. And so you just have to make sure you and your circle are not going to be bought. You know, the consultants all say, why do you think we do negative ads? Because they work. Why do they work? Because people are influenced by them. An informed electorate would be able to tell a lie from a truth. And certainly if someone is just doing nothing but a personal attack, that ought to be in and of itself a reason to vote for the other person. That's the only suggestion I have between now and November. Although a few, yeah, that's all.
Do you see any hope for a real campaign based upon the issues?
I have hope. I think the presidential campaign should be about the future and not the past. I think that the television networks ought to give time and cover the issues and try to please the people by doing so and not their advertisers. I think that we ought to ask the politicians to tell us, well, how are you going to raise the income level and employ more people long term? Is it big enough what you're saying? I think we ought to know, well, what is America's role in the world from your perspective? How specifically are you going to reduce the budget deficit? Questions like that. Do you think we need a big infrastructure? How will it be financed? And I think that, am I optimistic we're going to get that? Doubtful. It's still possible. People tend to rise to moments in surprising ways. It's a pretty big moment when you're running for president of the United States. And if we don't get it, it's going to be because consultants and money have conspired together to lower our level of discourse in American politics. And, you know, that's where we are. And you're only in charge of your own life and your own circle. But that, if enough of us use that to try to influence the process, it's better than feeling totally impotent.
In your book, and in your comments, you spoke about China and the managed economy of China and how it was moving forward. 20 years ago, most of the same things were being said about Japan. Are we seeing a rerun of the what happened in Japan? China has enormous issues and problems, a large class in poverty, infrastructure issues, pollution, so forth and so on.
I mean, China is different than Japan. It's 5 times larger, et cetera, et cetera. And I don't know if I'd count on somebody falling apart. I mean, Japan didn't create the world we thought they would. They're still a very valuable partner of ours. But I think the more important difference is in the 1970s, incomes of Americans were going up. The middle class still saw upward mobility. We still were a country that believed that through public action we could transform our lives collectively. And I think now China is, as I said, laying the groundwork. It could have problems. Sure, it's got pollution problems. It's got population problems. It's got the fact that a lot of, you have no way to really have information flow because of the repression. And those are big issues. They have 400 million middle class, which is more than the whole population of the United States. But they have 800 million very poor people as well. Chinese leaders are aware of that every day. They know they won't have credibility if people don't trust the food they eat or the trains they ride or whatever. So they're working on it. In our view, we should look at them as a potential partner, the infrastructure fund, and as a competitor simultaneously. And as Scott Fitzgerald once said, you know, the mark of real intelligence is to be able to do two opposite things simultaneously or something like that. But not a military adversary. And we will, if we go the military adversary route, with a country that's growing 8% a year or 10% a year, you know, and we're a country growing 1 or 2% a year, it's not a really wise thing. But we'd find some way to do it if there was a real threat. But my point is, there is no real threat right now.
Okay. Thank you. Unfortunately, we've reached the point in our program where there's time for only one last question. It's actually not going to be a question as much as a request. In your book, you tell an interesting story about you and Jesse Helms, who was the polar opposite of you. Would you mind telling that to this audience?
Sure. This is in the context of people working together. When I was in the Senate, people worked together across the aisle. But there was one senator that I had a problem with, and that was Jesse Helms. I thought his racist actions in the Senate and in campaigns turned me off. I thought his gay bashing revolted me. And then when he voted against the holiday for Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., a switch flipped off. And I really didn't want to talk to him. I didn't want to see him. I avoided him if he was walking down the hall. I didn't go into an elevator with him. I thought he was kind of the representative of the darker underside of America that's there in dwindling levels, but still there. And then one day I got a call from his wife, who I'd never met. And his wife said, Senator Bradley, our granddaughter is 19 years old, will come to Washington in 2 weeks, and she likes basketball. Would you talk to her? And I said, sure, have her show up at this playground at 6 o'clock in the evening, and I'll be there, and we'll shoot around and go over some things. So at 6 o'clock, up pulls this old green Oldsmobile, four-door green Oldsmobile, and in it are Senator and Mrs. Helms and their granddaughter. And they come out, and they come down. Here's the playground, and they sit down on the bench, and their granddaughter comes out on the court. So I throw her the ball and say, okay, take a shot, take another shot. Dribble your left twice and shoot. Dribble your right twice and shoot. Okay, go do a reverse pivot. Can you do a crossover dribble? And I realize in about 20 minutes that this girl is a player. And so we talk for another 20 or 30 minutes about defense, rebounding, and so forth. And then Senator and Mrs. Helms thank me profusely, and their granddaughter thanks me, and they get up and they get back in the old Oldsmobile and drive away. And from that moment on, I couldn't see him in the same light. Some of my self-righteousness was brought into question. And he still was a Neanderthal on these issues. But he was also a grandfather. And I couldn't get this image out of my mind of his him and his wife sitting smiling as their granddaughter was swishing shot after shot on that day. So anything's possible if we can find something good in somebody. Thank you.
Our thanks to Bill Bradley, former United States Senator from New Jersey and author of the new book, We Can All Do Better. We also thank our audiences here and on radio, television, and the Internet. I'm Joseph Fink, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.